Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we meet the prophet Elijah. We discuss his increasingly vulnerable existence through a period of drought and his ultimate reliance on another paradigmatically vulnerable character, a widow and her child who are already unable to take care of themselves. We talk about the idea of God's care during the hardest of times, and the pairing in this story of a miraculous healing with the more commonly encountered miracle of having just enough to last you through one more day. And speaking of increasingly vulnerable existences, we acknowledge our unreasonable dependence on the internet these days, and introduce a strange coping strategy to get through the moments when it's out. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, Amy. How are you this week?
I'm doing all right. It is good to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
It's really good to have this, like, constant thing that we do that we actually did before there was a pandemic.
Yeah.
Like, this was not a new, you know, as you said before, we Zoomed before Zoom was, a thing.
I love that. Bible Worm is, like, the constant in our lives. It's the one reliable thing that we can come back to each and every week.
That's right.
Yeah, then when we got on to record Bible Worm today and the internet went out just as we were starting to record, that was a little stressful.
I know. I mean, it's always been stressful when the internet's gone out, but it's just, it's taken a whole other level.
I will tell you that the fact that you have a plaintive ballad about the internet going out ready to roll.
I do.
Like 30 seconds after the internet was out, I get a text message with a song.
With a recording of me singing and playing the ukulele, which I'm sure was a great comfort to you.
No, it really was. I was
sweating through your clothes trying to figure out what you're going to do. Yeah, I wrote a very ridiculous song early in the pandemic because the level of stress in our household when the internet goes out now is just... Through the roof. And so at least it's something to do. Like, it's a little ritual. The internet goes out. Everyone grab your ukulele. It's time to sing a song.
Can you play just a little bit of it right now?
Sure.
I love that you have your ukulele. It's like ready to roll.
This is going to be amazing.
What will we do without the internet? The internet is broken.
That is amazing.
Now my internet fame will just go through go through the roof. Whole new level. So we are today in 1 Kings chapter 17.
We are.
So I know this is like an impossible question, but can you catch us up a little bit?
I mean, the basic gist of it is that kingship does not go well.
There are problems.
At the end of the reign of David's son Solomon, the kingdom splits into two, into the north, which is called Israel, and the south, which is called Judah. And the northern kingdom of Israel, from the get-go, is thought of as a sort of apostate, anti-Yahwist sort of place. Mm-hmm. Now, we learn, we're about 100 years or so, I don't quite know exactly, but we're somewhere in the 9th century, maybe 100 years after the time of Solomon, and... the king, Ahab, is, we learn in the previous chapter in 1 Kings 16, is married to Jezebel, who is a Phoenician woman. And she is a Baal worshiper. And so when Ahab and Jezebel are married, then Baal worship comes into Israel. And so now you're breaking kind of one of the main commandments of Deuteronomy, which is don't worship Baal and the gods of the Canaanites. And here now there's Baal worship in Israel. And so this is the problem that kind of motivates this text, that our prophet Elijah is responding to the presence of Baal worship in Ahab's Israel.
So we are in 1 Kings chapter 17. The narrative lectionary sort of gives an option of just doing 1 to 17 or doing the whole chapter through verse 24.
Have we ever not taken the option to do more text?
I don't think so.
So yeah, definitely 1 to 24. Like, why would you stop at 17? My goodness.
Okay, so starting with verse 1. Elijah the Tishbite, an inhabitant of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord lives, the God of Israel whom I serve, there will be no dew or rain except at my bidding." The word of the Lord came to him, "Leave this place, turn eastward and go into hiding by the Wadi Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You will drink from the wadi, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." He proceeded to do as the Lord had bidden. He went, and he stayed by the Wadi Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat every morning and every evening, and he drank from the wadi. So here, this is it. This is the first introduction to Elijah in the biblical text, right?
Yeah, we have not encountered Elijah, and then suddenly we're just sort of seemingly in the middle of an Elijah story.
Yeah, we just sort of drop right into it. All we know is he's a Tishbite, which is just tells us where he's from.
Yeah.
And then the first thing he says is related to dew and rain. There will be no dew and rain.
Yeah.
So can you, what do you see as the significance of that issue in particular?
It's a strange place for the text to start when you just read this text. Like, if you just flip open your Bible to 1 Kings 17 and you're like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. But if you read the very end of 1 Kings 16, what has just happened in the previous story is that Ahab has married Jezebel and they have started worshiping Baal, mm-hmm. the Canaanite god, the Phoenician god who Jezebel has worshipped. And so when Elijah comes and says, God says, there shall be neither dew nor rain except by my word, this is a response to Baal worship in Israel.
Right.
And it's kind of, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. One is we should probably say Elijah's name, Eliyahu, means my God is the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And so his name is communicating something about this issue with the Baals. And then this idea of rain and dew, in the Phoenician Canaanite understanding, Baal was the God, the storm God, the God who brought rain, the God who brought dew. So when the God of Israel says, look, by my word, there's not going to be any dew or any rain just for as long as I say, that is God saying, I'm the one who controls water, not Baal.
Right.
And so
it is a direct challenge to Baal and the idea that Baal has power in this rain or any power that God couldn't overpower.
Yeah. So we got a contest of God starting right at the very beginning. And who's going to be the real God?
The other thing I'll point out as we're just meeting Elijah, it's so funny that we're just meeting Elijah because most of us, I would say, as readers of the text, have heard so much about Elijah.
Yeah.
You know, we feel that we know so much about him already, but the text doesn't give us a lot of introduction.
Yeah.
It does add in here this famous or this well-known phrase, the word of the Lord came to him in verse 2, which is a pretty clear indication of his status as a prophet.
No, that's right. And in 1 Kings 18, Ahab refers to him as the troubler of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so there's clearly this antagonistic relationship between Elijah and the monarchy. And it starts right here. And, you know, Ahab is thinking he's going to do this thing where he's just going to incorporate Baal worship into Israel and it's going to be fine. And here comes this prophet to say, no, 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 you cannot do that. And there's this clear kind of friction. Animosity almost right from the very beginning.
Right. Very different than Nathan and David that we had in the last story, where Nathan is we pictured Nathan and David having a beer in the, in the palace and chit chatting about what they should do next. The king to which Elijah is speaking most certainly did not invite Elijah's input into what ought to be.
No. Yeah, definitely not. The language that, that scholars sometimes use for that is central prophets and peripheral prophets.
Yeah.
Nathan was a central prophet. He was located in the actual monarchy, part of the court of the king. Elijah is most certainly a peripheral prophet who lives on the margin somewhere and comes in every once in a while and announces usually bad stuff for the king. So when the word of the Lord comes to Elijah, what it says is, you better get out of here, right? Mm-hmm. And go live in this wadi for a while. What is that? What is that about?
So a wadi is it's an area of the desert. You have to picture a desert where everything is so dry that when it rains, the rain doesn't just sort of soak into the ground. It kind of rushes across the top of the ground into some area where it pools.
Yeah.
And that's what a wadi is. It's a little dip in the landscape where the water floods when there's water, and then it dries up when there's not water.
So I've been saying the Wadi Cherith. I think in Hebrew it's probably really Crete.
Yeah.
But, South Carolina boy, Cherith. do we know anything about the Wadi Cherith?
I don't personally know much about it. The note in my Jewish study Bible says that it's in the Transjordan. It may have been an Israelite territory, but outside of Ahab's jurisdiction.
Yeah, that, to me, that seems important. That so God has sent Elijah eastward, either to the Jordan or across the Jordan. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of like, if you go to this place that is out of the main area, I mean, I think what's happened is that like, Elijah's on the run, right? He's on the lam. He doesn't want to be found by Ahab. And so mm-hmm. get out of Israelite territory into this kind of marginal land and hide in this wadi. And because you just made this terrible announcement.
Because you just basically like lay down a threat, lay down a challenge, you know, yeah. saying until I say so, there's going to be no dew or rain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the prophecy that Elijah has made has gotten him into political trouble with Ahab. And now he's got to go hide in this kind of eastward Transjordanian region.
Yep, that's right. And then we get a raven.
The ravens.
I really like the idea of a raven bringing bread and meat every morning.
Yeah.
Does this have any particular resonance for you?
So, I mean, to me, the clearest reference is not about the raven, but is about the feeding of meat and bread in a wilderness area, okay. which has kind of clear, in my mind anyway, clear resonances with the story of the Israelites in the wilderness mm-hmm. in Exodus and Numbers. Mm-hmm. So this is God miraculously feeding Elijah in the wilderness in the same way, well, not in the same way, but in a way reminiscent of the way God miraculously fed Israel in the wilderness in their mm-hmm. time of wandering. Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts about the raven?
I mean, I don't have any thoughts that are really particular to the raven other than just really enjoying that image myself.
Yeah.
Other than the idea that sort of the natural world will be God's tool here, yeah. God's instrument in caring for Elijah.
Yeah, I like that too. So it would be different if it was like, hey, I'm going to drop bread from heaven or an angel's going to show up, you know, twice a day with a, you know, DoorDash in the Wadi Cherith.
A desert DoorDash.
But the fact that it's a raven, and I mean, ravens are scavengers, right? And so their sort of natural yeah. way of being in the world would be to eat the meat, I think.
Yeah.
And so the fact that God has had them deliver the meat so that Elijah can eat is kind of an interesting, like this, I like that way you're saying the cooperation of nature and God in the sustenance yeah. of this prophet.
Yeah, in a way, as you're saying, in a way that is a little unnatural, you know, to picture a raven
yeah.
bringing meat and leaving it for a person, let alone bread. I mean, what, the ravens baking bread at home?
Yeah.
But
yeah, you do kind of wonder where the bread came from, don't you?
I mean, you know, it's a miracle.
The other thing about that is, I mean, we're in an agrarian culture where having meat is kind of a rarity. Like, it's a yeah. special day when you get to eat meat. And here's Elijah hiding in the wadi, eating meat twice a day. Like, it's kind of interesting that there's a sense of like almost overabundance
yeah.
here. God is doing more than just like giving Elijah the bare minimum here. God is mm-hmm. taking care of him a little bit in style.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I really, really like that turn of phrase because now I'm picturing Elijah in like heels.
Yeah,
now,
and like the raven's got on a top hat and is like, hello, would you like some meat for your dinner?
I do. I like that in particular because as we go on in this story, I mean, God has certainly taken a shine to Elijah.
Yeah.
You know, Elijah has special treatment.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Okay. So picking up then in verse 7, after some time, the wadi dried up because there was no rain in the land. And the word of the Lord came to him, go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have designated a widow there to feed you. So he went at once to Zarephath. When he came to the entrance of the town, a widow was there gathering wood. He called out to her, please bring me a little water in your pitcher and let me drink. As she went to fetch it, he called out to her, please bring along a piece of bread for me. As the Lord your God lives, she replied, I have nothing baked, nothing but a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I am just gathering a couple of sticks so that I can go home and prepare it for me and my son, We shall eat it and then we shall die. Don't be afraid, said Elijah to her. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a small cake from what you have there and bring it out to me. Then make some for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not give out, and the jug of oil shall not fail until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the ground. She went and did as Elijah had spoken, and she and her household had food for a long time. The jar of flour did not give out, nor did the jug of oil fail, just as the Lord had spoken through Elijah. All right, so here's the miraculous feeding of Elijah part two, right?
Yeah, but it's quite a different story.
Does it surprise you at all that this starts with the wadi drying up? Like, it seems like the wadi could just, like, God already has ravens bringing meat to him and bread somehow. Why doesn't God just keep the that wadi wet?
Yeah, or like give the raven like a thermos and it could just fly over to the Jordan and be like, dip, dip, and then fly back. Like, I mean, there's all kinds of things that could happen here. And so it's interesting. Like, I think the wadi drying up is interesting. I mean, it's like, it's what wadis do.
Right.
And it's a
drought.
You're
exactly right. So this is a case in which, like, the sort of natural order of the world continues on the path that you would expect. The wadi
drying up. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it amplifies the severity of the drought. Like, the drought is such that it affects even God's own prophets and puts, like, Elijah's life. I mean, we don't get much detail here about Elijah's life being at risk, but like when you read the wadi dried up, there's no rain, then you think like, oh yeah, it's like, it's hard to be a prophet hiding in the wilderness when there's no rain. And so, so this thing that Elijah has prophesied, like it hits close to home for him too.
We've talked a little bit about what we know about the different places that are mentioned here. Do we know anything about Zarephath?
Yeah, Zarephath is actually, I mean, it's so interesting. Zarephath is in Phoenician territory. It's about halfway between Tyre and Sidon. Mm. And if you remember, this is where Jezebel is from. She's actually from Sidon. And so she's not from Zarephath. She's, you know, this is within about 10 or 12 miles of where Jezebel is from. And so I don't know quite what the text is doing here, but we assume, I think, that this woman is Phoenician. We probably would assume this woman is a Baal worshiper.
Mm.
She's in Phoenician territory. She says the Lord your God, not the Lord our God.
Yeah.
And so there's this fascinating thing, I think, happening where, like, it's one thing for God to be doing miraculous things in the Wadi Cherith, sort of east of Israel. And it seems like another thing for God to be doing miraculous things, like, in Phoenicia. Like, he's on Baal's home turf now and doing these things.
That is so interesting. You know, when I read this text, it was just as the last story reminded you of the miraculous provision of manna for the Israelites when they were in the desert, this story reminds me a little bit of Abraham sending his servant back to Abraham's original homeland to look for a wife for Isaac.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And there's this sort of like, you know, the servant is looking for signs, and one of the signs is that Rebecca brings him water and some food and, you know, such and such and such. But what you just pointed out reminded me that the servant is sent back into territory that it sort of has not been claimed by God in some way, or where God is not the predominantly worshipped deity.
Yeah.
That's an interesting layer. I mean, what I was going to ask you is I've asked you what you thought about the raven.
Yeah.
And certainly widows have a lot of resonance in the biblical text. I don't know if there was one you want. Talk about the widow a little bit, and then we can try to layer together this widow with a widow in Phoenicia.
In an ancient culture, women were, like, their security was in being attached to a man normally. So either a husband or a son. Here we have a widow who does have a son, and she seems to be a property owner. Like, there is a house, and in the next story, there's a house with an upper room. So, like, they've got a multi-level house.
Mm-hmm.
So my impression is that she is not somebody who's, like, on, at least previous to the drought, was not on the edge of poverty, but she is now in this moment pretty vulnerable because of this thing, because the rain has dried up.
Yeah, she says, we're going to eat some flour and die.
Yeah. Yeah. So like 6 months ago, like she was getting along fine. And then God comes in and does this thing to Ahab in Israel, which creates a vulnerability for this widow in Phoenicia who was not previously vulnerable. Like she's like somebody who like, I mean, this is totally anachronistic, but like she's somebody that's like hanging on in the middle class. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, say a global pandemic comes along and suddenly her vulnerabilities are exposed.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting connection. Yeah, I like that.
What would you want to say about widows and or this widow in particular?
I mean, I guess my reading of the widow in general is widows are understood to be vulnerable members of the community. And when a widow is able to provide such as this widow is able to provide in this story, we can safely assume that she would not have been able to do that without God's help. So, you know, underscores God works through the most vulnerable in society in part to make it really clear that it had to be God doing that and not she just had some extra bread laying around. She did not.
This line that she says is so tragic. Mm-hmm. I am gathering a couple of sticks. So you even get the sense that there's not much wood around, right?
Yeah.
So that I may go home and prepare for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. So like they are literally preparing their last meal and then they're just going to starve to death. Like that is as vulnerable as you get. Yeah. And so this is who God chooses. God sends the prophet to someone who has no food with a command that she should feed the prophet.
Feed someone else.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, this is not, as you pointed out, this is not someone who already worships the God of Israel.
Yeah.
But she's willing to do it.
Yeah.
You know, like I could envision a situation where I would be like, that would be a no.
Yeah.
I don't know you and you're going to have to figure this out yourself. Like I've got my own problems to deal with.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make you a cake.
Yeah, no, like, could you bake me a cake? There's a couple of things.
Yeah, first, make me a cake, then you can feed you and your starving son. Like, I mean,
that's basically what Elijah says. Yeah,
that is so exactly what Elijah says.
Like, I realize you're about to eat your last little morsel, but could you just give it to me instead, and then, and then go make something for your son and yourself?
Yeah.
Now, what do you do with the? So, what's going to happen is the jar of meal. By the power of God, the jar of meal will not be emptied and the jug of oil will not fail until God sends rain on the earth. And that's the way it turns out. Mm-hmm. Any just thoughts about that, the nature of that miracle?
I think my first thought is that it underscores for me again the ways in which Elijah's special. Like, God has a special relationship to Elijah, and now that this widow has sort of thrown in her fate with Elijah by being willing to go out on a limb and give him some of her food when she thought that was all she had, now she is sort of protected by that magical umbrella of Elijah-ness.
I like that.
What would you say about this?
So in one way, this seems different to me than the Wadi story, in that there Elijah was getting meat and bread twice a day. Like he was living a little luxuriously, given that he was in a Wadi. Yeah. This miracle is you're going to have just what you need. Like you are going to be in the position that you were already in, where you're making your last meal with your last meal and your last oil. You're going to be in that position every day until the rain comes again, but it's never going to run out. So you're going to live on the very edge of your vulnerability.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that sort of came to my mind as you were talking was that I think I have this narrative in my head of, you know, when times are rough, you endure something rough and then it almost immediately starts getting better.
Yeah.
And here it's like, there is something that is rough in its own way. Like when he's living in the desert and having food brought to him by the birds, like that is vulnerable. It's true. He's getting kind of fancy food, but he still is totally at the mercy of this bird transport system.
Yeah.
But it gets worse.
Yeah.
Before it gets better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In some ways that seems more true to life. I mean, I guess it depends what the situation is, but it's a good, I think, corrective to this more Hallmarky narrative in my head that you go through a hard time and then it gets better pretty quick.
I think that's a good insight. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on into the optional verses.
The optional.
17. After a while, the son of the mistress of the house fell sick, and his illness grew worse until he had no breath left in him. She said to Elijah, "What harm have I done you, O man of God, that you should come here to recall my sin and cause the death of my son? Give me the boy," he said to her, and taking him from her arms, he carried him to the upper chamber where he was staying and laid him down on his own bed. He cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord my God, will you bring calamity upon this widow whose guest I am and let her son die?" Then he stretched out over the child three times and cried out to the Lord, saying, "O Lord my God, let this child's life return to his body." The Lord heard Elijah's plea. The child's life returned to his body, and he revived. Elijah picked up the child and brought him down from the upper room into the main room and gave him to his mother. "See," said Elijah, "your son is alive." And the woman answered Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord is truly in your mouth."
Yours in verse 20, Elijah says something like allowing her son to die or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The NRSV says, "You have brought calamity upon the widow by killing her son."
Oh. Yeah,
and so I looked, and the Hebrew is actually lehamit, which is like to kill.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's mm-hmm. Passive action. It's an active action. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was interesting. Like there is this sort of, I mean, and I'm curious what you think about it, but she has suggested in verse 18 that God is causing the death of her son based on some unstated sin. Elijah seems to kind of accept that interpretation in verse 20. "I hear I came to stay with this woman and now you're going to kill her son." Any
I mean,
thoughts
I
about
read what she
there?
Says in verse 18, not as she thinks God has done this, but she thinks Elijah has done this. "What harm have I done you, O man of God, that you should come here to recall my sin and cause the death of my son?" That she's blaming, she thinks Elijah has the power to have done this.
That's interesting. In the NRSV, it's to bring my sin to remembrance. Hebrew lehazkir, I think, could mean maybe either one. Like, the way that I read the NRSV is by coming to her house, Elijah has called God's attention to her,
mm-hmm.
and God has remembered her sin, mm-hmm. and that has caused the death of her son.
You know, like I spoke before about, now you're under Elijah's umbrella. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And there is congratulations, but there's also, maybe she fears, or maybe it's true, a different expectation of what is acceptable from you, you know? And so by being sort of part of Elijah's circle can also be a dangerous thing.
That's kind of how I read it, you know, yeah. And it was reminding me a little bit of, like, one of the lessons of the book of Job, and maybe a little bit Ecclesiastes, mm-hmm. is you kind of, maybe you want to fly under the radar a little bit.
Yeah. That's right.
And if God notices you for whatever reason, like God notices Job because Job is so righteous, then that causes Job's world to kind of fall apart. So whether for righteousness or unrighteousness, you kind of don't want God to notice you. And so Elijah showing up at her house like brings her into this story.
That's really interesting. And I think you're right.
So we've been talking about what the woman thinks is happening. Like, why is her son ill?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Like, has God made her son ill, or has this been a sort of natural occurrence that she attributes to God, but God didn't actually have anything to do with it? How do you read that?
I mean, I don't see anything in here that suggests that this was like an intentional, her son was singled out in some kind of punitive way.
I mean, she thinks so, right?
She thinks so.
And Elijah seems to at least sort of acknowledge that it depends on whether you read the JPS or the NRSV, I guess. Like in the NRSV,
yeah. mm-hmm.
"Have you brought calamity by killing her son?" makes it sound like God is like causing it. The
right.
NJPS sounds like it
sounds
just
like
sort
this
of
is
happens.
Just something that's happening that maybe
allowing
God
her.
Should be preventing because
yeah.
Elijah is there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like
you're
reading
right.
it that way a lot more, that like he just happens to get ill and God saves the day, or Elijah saves the day.
Right.
So if you read it that way, do you read this, and I don't know that this really matters, but do you read this kid as like near unto death or on the other side, like he has already walked into the light, so to speak?
I don't see him as dead yet. I see him as near unto death.
Near unto death.
so poetically said it. But now I'm looking back in the text to see if there's really grounds for that, or if that's...
So, I mean, verse 17 says, his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him.
That sounds pretty bad.
Which is bad. And so I don't know, like, one could read that as, like, he should be on a ventilator.
Yeah.
Or one could read that as literally the life breath has gone out of him.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right, you're right.
But either way you read it, like, his death has either just occurred or his death is inevitable. Like, he is, for all intents and purposes, he has or is about to die.
Do you think Elijah was confident that his plea would be answered?
My read of it, now that you ask it that way, is no, I actually don't. And the reason I say that is because, like, this prayer that he prays is, like, it's not like, hey, God, you got this. It's, have you brought calamity even on this widow with whom I am staying by killing her son?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a pretty desperate
prayer. It's pretty impassioned, desperate plea. Yeah, it seems so to me.
Mm-hmm. And then he stretches out. So there's performing some kind of magical ritual, stretching out over his whole body and crying out, let this Lord's life come into him again. Like, this is a very physical, like, anguished, at least in my reading, kind of act. It's not the sort of, like, Lazarus come out of the tomb to cite a resurrection from the New Testament. You know, this is like Elijah has really had to pour himself into this.
Yeah.
And in a way that seems a little desperate to me, like he's not sure what God's actually going to do.
Yeah. All right, Bobby, now that we have made this text much more complicated than it was just a short time ago, what would you pull out for folks today?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things as a Christian reader of this text is that I'm aware that this text is the reading in churches that are following the narrative lectionary on All Saints Day on November 1st, I think it is. All Saints Day in the Christian tradition is the time when we remember people who have died, especially people who have died in the recent year, but also people who have, you know, just all saints, people who have gone before. And so it's kind of an interesting context to be reading a text that is about resurrection. And the first two of these stories are about being on the edge of death, right? The natural world has dried up. There is food is uncertain. Mm-hmm. There is miraculous sort of intervention to keep people alive. And then the last story is about, in some sense or another, the crossing over into death and the resurrection that Elijah enacts. And so these kind of things kind of mingle around in this really interesting way. Kind of the way that I'm putting it together right now is that those first two stories are saying something about how God sustains people in difficult times, that, you know, Elijah's in hiding and here come the ravens. Elijah runs out of water, and so he goes to see this woman. And what we were talking about with that story in Zarephath, that they are living on the edge of death every day. Like, they are just getting by. They have just enough meal. They have just enough oil. And I think that's such an interesting thing to think about in the context of mourning or suffering or, you know, being at the edge of death or despair in some way, that there is a period when that's what you can do, is you just get through. Like, you have just enough to get through today, and you get up tomorrow and you have just enough to get through tomorrow. That is every bit as much a miracle as the miracle story at the end where there's a resurrection, that the survival of the next day through God's provision is a miracle in itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important message for maybe for all people, and maybe for people living in a pandemic, but especially for people who have lost loved ones who, you know, are mourning that loss. And sometimes what they can muster is they can get through today.
Yeah.
And to recognize the miracle that's there. That last story where there is a resurrection, you know, for a Christian reader, that little resurrection that Elijah enacts there is a foretaste of the general resurrection that Christians anticipate coming when God's kingdom comes in its fullness. And so there is this sense at the end of this text that when you make it through day to day, today, today, then at the end, at the culmination, at the fulfillment of all things, like this God who can get you through today is also the God who can resurrect in the end. And so I think there is also this pointing toward this kind of more dramatic restoration of life where there was only death. But the emphasis in this text is the preservation of life day to day, moment to moment, in the presence of impending death, mm-hmm. which I think is a pretty dramatic telling of a miracle that in my mind is pretty close to the way that a lot of us live our lives, and especially in these days, but maybe in all days.
I love that. That's a really beautiful reading, Bobby. And it's helpful to me because, I mean, you know, you've read enough text with me that I struggle with these stories of miraculous healing.
Yeah.
You know, because they're one in a million and most of us are the other 999,000.
Yeah.
And that one doesn't need a word of encouragement.
Like, yeah.
Like we need a word of encouragement for the one, for all of us who are not going to have this miraculous healing, at least in the way that it is literally laid out here in this text.
Yeah, that's right.
But I really, really like the idea that it is indeed a miracle to get what you need to move through every day. And the reality that things get hard and they're hard and you feel vulnerable. And then sometimes it gets worse.
Yeah.
From there.
Yeah.
And we may be surprised sort of how long we can sustain ourselves with just the littlest bit through the hardest time. And there may yet still be something better on the other side of it.
Yeah.
I think that these miracle texts can be hard because they can raise the question, you know, well, if God could do it for this child.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why didn't God do it for my child?
Absolutely.
You know, like resurrection mm-hmm. later on is great.
Yeah.
But if someone is facing the death of a child or a loved one, it really would be nice to have something pretty literal and in this moment like we get in this story. And so it's a little hard for me to wrestle with these.
Yeah, absolutely.
With these stories. But I love that reading of the miracle of the day to day and just moving through your lot for that day, moving through your work, moving through your family obligations, moving through caring for your body.
Yeah.
Whatever you're able to do will be enough, and trusting that it will be enough. And all you have to do is get through the next thing. And you honestly can't predict what's going to happen after that one way or the other.
That's right.
So yes, wildly vulnerable and hopeful and hard.
Yes. That's well.
Yeah. Yeah. All of those things. Well, it is a pleasure, as always, to talk with you about these texts.
Yes, indeed. Next week, we're going to try to talk about the whole book of Jonah.
Wonderful. I love the book of Jonah. I look forward to that. I hope you have a good week, and we will talk again soon.
All right, Amy. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We're grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest supporters, Nancy McHugh, Stephen Schmidt, and Steve Bonachow.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing the Book of Jonah. Until then, keep on digging.